Case number 07-5391, Wendy A. Oscarson versus Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms, Appellant. Ms. Bach for the appellant, Mr. Kuman for the appellee.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Stacey Bach, and I represent the Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction because, first, Ms. Oscarson failed to meet her burden of showing that jurisdiction was proper, and second, the facts in the record as set forth by Ms. Oscarson and taken as true by the Senate Sergeant at Arms make clear that as a matter of law, she failed to timely exhaust administrative remedies after her claim accrued, which is a jurisdictional prerequisite to suit and an express condition on Congress's waiver.
When you say lack subject matter jurisdiction, you realize that that is rarely, if ever, a ground for interlocutory review, right?
I do, Your Honor.
For example, if this were a diversity case and it turns out that the district court wrongly concluded that there was diversity, there wouldn't be an immediate appeal, right? There would be a trial, and then we would consider that question.
Your Honor, in this case, however, there's a sovereign immunity overlay with respect to 12b-1. And when you look at the Congressional Accountability Act, the two analyses actually converge.
Okay, so if this weren't a so whether assume for the moment, as you are, that if it's jurisdictional, you get an interlocutory appeal. Would you agree that if it's not jurisdictional, that is, if it's not a jurisdictional element of this cause of action, that you would not get an interlocutory appeal? That the only thing that could possibly permit an interlocutory appeal here is if this had to do with the court's jurisdiction. If this were just an element of the cause of action, for example.
Well, to the extent the court views this as an element of the waiver of sovereign immunity, there's...
Well, when you say, that's what I'm trying to get, when you say it's an element of the sovereign immunity, I mean, theoretically, you could be saying every single aspect of the cause of action here is such an element, which would mean that every time the district court makes a decision on anything, one by one, we would have to hear it interlocutorily. You're not making that argument, are you?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that the elements that are expressly set forth in the jurisdictional grant as part and parcel of the condition on the waiver of immunity.
And if they weren't, if this particular one, that's the timeliness of the going to the counselor, were not in the jurisdictional grant, then you would agree there would be no interlocutory appeal. Is that right?
I believe that's right, Your Honor.
So then can we look together at the jurisdictional grant?
Sure, Your Honor.
That's 1408A. And that says, title jurisdiction, first sentence, the court shall have jurisdiction over any civil action commenced under section 1404 by a covered employee who has completed counseling under section 1402. It doesn't say who has completed counseling in a timely manner. It doesn't say who asked for counseling in a timely manner. It just says completed counseling, right?
It says specifically, Your Honor, under 1402.
Yes.
And that plain language evinces Congress's intent to incorporate all of the requirements that are set forth in section 1402.
Well, you got me with, I like the words plain language, but the evinces part doesn't get me there. It doesn't say anything about all aspects of 1402. It just says who has completed counseling under 1402. Why would it have to? I mean, there are a number of Supreme Court opinions, Irwin and Scarborough versus Principi, all about time limits, all which say that these are not jurisdictional, that these instead are equitable tolling. I guess the Harbor, I think the Y&R Harbor or whatever that one's called, all of which say that unless Congress quite clearly says that a timing question is jurisdictional, we're to regard it as an element of cause of action or an exhaustion requirement or something that can be equitably told. And this jurisdictional section does not say anything about timeliness.
Well, let me first address the Irwin issue. In Irwin, Your Honor, the court was not construing a jurisdictional grant, which is completely different than the situation in 1408.
But there was a jurisdictional grant. It's just that the timing part wasn't in it. And that's the question here.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly right. The timeliness provision was not at issue in the jurisdictional grant in Irwin. That's what makes this case different.
Well, that only makes it different if it is at issue in this one. And I'm asking you to, you know, other than your statement that it's plain, which doesn't appear to me to be plain, what is it that's telling you that Congress meant something more than just completing the counseling?
Your Honor, the words under 1402, I think, are the key phrase in the jurisdictional grant. Under, its natural meaning means in accordance with. So what Congress is saying is complete or to perfect counseling in accordance with Section 1402. One of the requirements there is that a plaintiff file a claim within 180 days of the date the cause of action accrues. One of the other requirements is that the claim actually be cognizable under the CAA. So the court, the Congress, by saying under 1402, is incorporating not only the timeliness requirement, but also the requirement that this is actually an employment law that has been waived.
And when you say cognizable, what do you think that means?
I mean, it's pursuant to the waiver of immunity. For example, if you look at the congressional...
But I mean, what
sounds as if you're bringing in the
now it
horribles that Judge Garland was referring to, in which every element of the tort becomes jurisdictional, and therefore there's interlocutory appeal at every moment.
No, Your Honor, not every element of the tort, but at least that there must be a waiver according to the terms of the Congressional Accountability Act, for example. The Congressional Accountability Act, if you look at the terms of it, does not put Congress precisely under every employment law as they apply everywhere else. For example, the FLSA is very limited in what is incorporated under the CAA. The record-keeping provisions, the child labor law provisions are not laws that Congress has waived its immunity for. So 1402 requires also that Congress actually has waived its immunity with respect to the claim you're asserting under the CAA. And that's the only place where it shows up in terms of the jurisdictional grant. I think if someone were to bring forth a suit saying the child labor laws under the CAA, we would look at it and say, no, there's no jurisdiction for that class of cases.
Which words are you referring to now when you say it has to be cognizable? Which part? Are you importing 1402 or 1404?
1402, Your Honor, it says to commence a proceeding a covered employee alleging a violation of a law made applicable under Part A.
Are you only saying that it has to allege a violation of the law under Part A? Is that that's all
yes.
you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Basically, in this case, it's ADA. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's all you're saying.
It's saying made applicable, so you have to look at the particular provision. So if there were an ADA provision that were not made applicable under the waiver of immunity, there would be no way for the subject matter.
Which ADA provision is not applicable?
I'm not saying there is. In here, Your Honor, the ADA provisions are applicable. However, under other provisions of the law, for example, the FLSA, the Title VII retaliation provision, have not been incorporated. So in Section 1408, Congress incorporating the entirety of 1402.
Saying, so retaliatory action under the ADA is not included? Is that what you're saying?
There is a separate retaliation provision under the Congressional Accountability Act.
Uh-huh. And what about the elements of an ADA claim? Are those all jurisdictional also, on your view?
No, Your Honor.
They're not?
No.
Okay.
Just the terms that are set forth. The class of cases set forth in Section 1408, and that means it needs to be a civil action alleged by a person who is a covered employee who has completed or perfected counseling in accordance with Section 1402.
It doesn't say in accordance. It just says under Section 1402.
Your Honor, Webster's and Oxford has in accordance as one of the definitions of under.
I can just try to explore your contention more. You're arguing, I think, a parallelism between under Section 1402 and under Section 1404, and your earlier discussion I may not have, if I don't have 1404 correctly in mind, tell me. But that is where you're arguing that a discrimination claim not made applicable to Congress by the Congressional whatever Accountability Act, if it clearly didn't allege the things that are necessary to be alleged to fit within the act, then there would be no jurisdiction. So, I mean, we certainly do have statutes which say that there's no jurisdiction unless there is an allegation of a particular type.
No, you know, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that every 12b-6 argument is jurisdictional. It's only because Congress set forth in section 1408, it's entitled Civil Action. Subsection A is actually entitled Jurisdiction, and that's the clause that sets forth the classes of cases over which the district court has power to adjudicate.
Then you're making a retreat that I'm a little puzzled by. In other words, you're saying there's no problem under 1408 with a civil action that raises a type of claim not countenanced by the Congressional Accountability Act. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is 1402 by expressly incorporating 1408 by expressly incorporating 1402 gets that requirement in. Because in order to convict to a covered employee alleging a violation of a law made applicable, so it has to be a law that's made applicable.
Okay.
So to the extent, going back, it's taken me a long time to get here, going back to Judge Garland's point that it doesn't say timely exhaustion, it does say that by incorporating under 1402. To the extent it would have said timely exhaustion, it would have been redundant and also underbroad. Because by incorporating under section 1402, you're also incorporating that requirement that it actually has to be a law that was made applicable under the Congressional Accountability Act.
And if you look at the
legislative history, it's clear that timely exhaustion.
There isn't legislative history. There is a single line-by-line analysis introduced by a single senator, right?
By the two co-sponsors of the litigation.
Right.
And in
you would agree that this is generally this kind of legislative history, which is something added during a floor debate, is not generally regarded as the strongest kind. This is not a committee report, right?
It is not a committee report, but in the Donovan case, this court has held that the section-by-section analysis introduced by co-sponsors is probative of the intent of Congress. And here the intent of Congress was very clear, that the timely exhaustion requirement is part and parcel of the jurisdictional grant. It makes clear that if you fail to request counseling within the time required, it bars an employee from proceeding under the Act. And if you look at that language as compared to, for example, the legislative history pointed out in the Zipes case with respect to Title VII, it's completely different. The legislative history under Title VII suggests that Congress was okay with it being equitably told. That's not the language we have here. Congress made it clear that it made a reasoned decision to waive its own immunity from suit and put itself under various employment laws as prescribed by itself. And when it did so, it did that in a very limited way. And the conditions on that waiver need to be strictly construed.
Can we turn to your argument, your effort to deflect Johnson versus Jones? You say at a number of points, well, both in your opening brief and your reply brief, that the sergeant-at-arms is not contesting, for purposes of this motion, the facts alleged by the plaintiff. And you seem to think that that throws Johnson versus Jones out of the picture. But Johnson versus Jones, it seems to me, made perfectly clear that it did not contemplate interlocutory review under Cohen of rulings which took a sort of a complex set of facts and ruled that that pattern added up to there we're dealing with qualified immunity, established the absence or presence of qualified immunity. The question of whether the law, the right violated, was clearly established. So, the line drawn in Johnson is somewhat different. It looks for something indicating a clear issue of law, a clear, comparatively simple issue of law, not the sort of issue of law that's sort of the bread and butter of ordinary summary judgment actions.
Well, Your Honor, the facts here are undisputed. We've taken everything that Ms. Oskarson has said as true for purposes of this motion. And in Mitchell v. Forsythe and in Johnson v. Jones, the court said that the second prong of the collateral order doctrine is met when you're only making a legal determination based on even plaintiffs.
But not every legal determination. I think Johnson is really clear on that. There are lots of legal determinations that are not covered by it. I mean, I'm sorry, that are not susceptible to interlocutory review under Mitchell.
Yes, Your Honor, when it's dealing with the evidence sufficiency, when it's a summary judgment motion, what was there enough facts to support a particular version of the events? Here we don't have that issue.
Don't we have the question of whether we have a set of facts which triggered the 180-day time limit?
Yes, Your Honor, and those facts are undisputed, and this court can...
Facts are undisputed, but facts can be very complicated and undisputed at the same time. That could be true with relation to the facts governing qualified immunity, and it's that kind of issue that Johnson says is not susceptible to interlocutory review.
Well, I mean, looking at a different area of the law, for example, under FISA, if it's a commercial activity, that can be a very complicated set of facts. It can be undisputed, and this court has reviewed that on an interlocutory basis. The key inquiry is whether the facts are undisputed, and here they are.
I don't think that is the key inquiry under Johnson at all.
So Johnson says that if the district court says there is a genuine issue of material fact, that you cannot have interlocutory review, right?
Your Honor, that may be, but the court has never said there's a genuine issue of material fact with respect to the accrual issue.
We don't know what the judge said here, right? It's a minute order.
It is a minute order, Your Honor, but because the review here is de novo as well as it was with the court below.
It's de novo on the question of whether there's a genuine issue of material fact, because that's the review of summary judgment, but that was also the case in Johnson. And the court said that legal question, and that's a legal question, but the court said that legal question is not one that gets interlocutory review.
Let me read you a sentence from Johnson. Where, however, a defendant simply wants to appeal the district court's determination that the evidence is sufficient to permit a particular finding of fact after trial, and then it goes on to explain that where that if clause applies, essentially we're not in the area of interlocutory appeal under Cohen.
But the denial of the district court is the denial of the claim of sovereign immunity from suit.
That's the bottom line. There's no doubt about it. But the basis of that denial can fit into the category of a sort of minute study of complicated facts as opposed to a clear ruling of law, which is what Johnson tried to limit Mitchell to.
And I believe it may be that Johnson case or the other Johnson case where the court said, unfortunately, sometimes this may require
the Barron case to look
specifically at the record and make these sort of fact-intensive discussions.
If you look carefully, you see that what it really refers to, it says it may be cumbersome and difficult even to draw the line between the type of, to ascertain from what the district court did, whether it's the sort of disposition on a basis of a clear proposition of law or simply a sort of minute fact-by-fact teasing out of whether summary judgment should or should not be granted.
Well, I think my answer is, again, I'm repeating myself, but first, it's there are no disputed facts. And when you look at these disputed facts, it's very clear.
Get you home free under Johnson.
But it's very clear under this particular set of facts that her claim is time-barred based on the assertions that she's made and all inferences in her favor. It shows that, as a matter of law, she was articulating the injury that is asserted as the basis of this lawsuit at various points from August 31st.
I actually think that if their definition of delay were adopted, you would be right. Because their definition is you can sue any time up to and including the grant of the accommodation or the denial of the accommodation. And if, what is it, 180 days?
Yes.
If 180 days had passed after either of those events, then we would have a very clear issue, and that might be the end of it. But your definition is that they had to reasonably know about delay, right?
What's your definition? That she knew or should have known, and that the facts to actually show she
knew or should have known what?
Of the injury that's asserted, which is the delay. The delay of receiving the accommodation.
And you think that should be the test. Is that right?
The test that has been employed by this circuit before and various other circuits is knew or should have known of the injury.
I'm asking you in the delay context, though. Could you word the test for me?
She knew or should have known of the delay in receiving the accommodation.
Right. Now, how much delay is the delay that creates an injury in your view?
The delay is the delay that the plaintiff actually believes in their experience as an employee.
But that's not enough to create a cause of action. Is your view that any time an employee thinks there's been too much delay, that's enough to recover under the ADA?
Your Honor.
Doesn't it have to be, wouldn't it have to be reasonable, unreasonable delay or something like that, or not?
It does, Your Honor, but here we have an actual statement from her putting forth her point of view, which in the context and the record shows that it was, in fact, reasonable as well.
Right, unreasonable?
It was.
So you would agree, then, that there was unreasonable delay at that point?
I believe that on the record, if what she's saying is true, that she asked for an accommodation in May of 2002 and had believed that she fully documented the accommodation by November, that's a seven-month period.
Well, the position of I just want to be clear for the future, the position of the Office of the Senate Sergeant at Arms is a seventh-month delay is a violation of the ADA, and any employee of the Senate should know that they should be able to recover after 7 months. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor.
It's not because it depends on the facts of the case?
Well, it depends on the facts of the case, and obviously we're making alternative arguments. We're not bound, obviously it's not a shock to the court that we don't agree with the version of the facts as put forth by the plaintiff.
Well, if you don't agree, you agree with the facts, that is, you agree that she said as of that day she hadn't gotten it.
And not only that she hadn't gotten it, but that she articulated that our response had been stalled, that we had completely dropped the ball, that she had fully documented the request, that requests for documentation were not real requests, they weren't government forms. Anyone with a belief of that should have taken...
If those things were true, you would then agree that there was a violation? 7 months with those things is a violation?
I would agree that it's not, I wouldn't necessarily, the accrual issue is different from the merits issue, Your Honor. I would agree that someone could
Why is the accrual issue different from the merits? It only accrues if a meritorious claim has occurred by that time, right? If it would take another 2 months before it becomes a meritorious claim, then they would have to wait another 2 months, wouldn't they?
No, Your Honor. I mean, claims accrue irrespective of whether you're going to win on the merits all the time. We see a plethora of cases in the district court with respect to employment laws where a claim accrues, but the person may not necessarily
Imagine
win.
Imagine the rule were that it takes 9 months of delay before it's sufficiently unreasonable to make out a claim, and she sued after only 7 months, and she thought 7 months was enough. You think they have to sue before a meritorious claim has arisen?
Your Honor, the burden is on the plaintiff to take steps to investigate their legal rights once they're on notice of an injury. So if a person believes that the delay is harming them, that they are owed something, they have the duty to then investigate whether a claim is cognizable. And the newer should have known standard appropriately balances the interest between the plaintiffs and the defendants in litigation, and especially in the ADA context, for example, where the point of these failure to accommodate claims is to provide a disabled employee with the tools they need in order to do their job. So if a person actually believes they can't do their job and that they're owed an accommodation, it actually furthers the point of the ADA to ensure that this person promptly files in order to get equitable relief and monetary relief for any alleged delay.
We'll let you come back. Mr. Kuhman?
May it please the court, my name is Avi Kuhn. I'm representing the plaintiff appellee, in this case, Wendy Oskarson. The court, I think, was right on point in terms of questioning the sergeant-at-arms about the jurisdictional question in this case. The sergeant-at-arms has asked this court to make several illogical leaps in order to be entitled to interlocutory review. They've taken a garden-variety timeliness question, dressed that up as a jurisdictional issue, dressed that up as a sovereign immunity issue, dressed that up as a claim that they're entitled to sovereign immunity even for claims of federal sovereign immunity, which the case law does not support, and then claim that they can bring that petition for interlocutory review at any time, even if they have sat on their rights
for years. What if Congress had said, a condition on the waiver of our sovereign immunity is a timely filing of a request for counseling?
That's correct, but 1408...
What if they had said that? And under those circumstances,
under
you
those
would agree...
Under those circumstances, I agree with you.
There would be interlocutory appeal.
That's right. Typically for most issues of subject matter jurisdiction, but not necessarily in the context of federal sovereign immunity.
Well, what about congressional sovereign
about
immunity?
Federal sovereign immunity? I mean, Senate Sergeant-at-Arms cites a Westfall Act case where, now that's a particular form of federal sovereign immunity.
I believe that's the...
But interlocutory review is approved in the strongest terms there. It hasn't got it to turn on the particular statute.
I believe that's the Osborne versus Haley case that Your Honor is referring to. And in that case, it was an official immunity case. And several circuits have held that that is simply a different analysis than cases for federal sovereign immunity.
Official immunity. Immunity is out there. And the question, it would seem to me, in looking at a particular immunity case is statute by statute to see whether there are indications that Congress believed that it makes sense to have a threshold appealable condition on the waiver of immunity. The only clue here, as Judge Garland has said, the only item asserted by the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms is the wording of 1408 and its cross-references.
In reviewing the issue of immunity, several circuits have held that not all immunities are the same for the purposes of interlocutory appeal. The Seventh Circuit has held that federal sovereign immunity is not entitled to interlocutory review.
What they say about federal sovereign immunity is that there are all kinds of incursions on federal sovereign immunity, the Federal Tort Claims Act, et cetera. But those all have to do with suits against the government, qua government, or against the executive branch. This practice of the Congress permitting suits against itself is not something which for the last 100 years bits and bits of the sovereign immunity have been waived. This is only a mid-90s phenomenon, isn't that right?
That's correct.
And it's a pretty narrow one. There's one statute that waives only under some conditions with respect to some statutes. So even if we were to accept Judge Easterbrook's opinion for the Seventh Circuit, which this Court has not yet decided one way or the other, in fact, it's expressly said we're not deciding, why would that apply to the much more limited and much more recent waiver that Congress has provided for itself?
Well, for one, 1408 does not make timeliness a jurisdictional prerequisite.
That's a different question.
That's the question.
But that is a different question. That is, Easterbrook's position is that there have been so many waivers with respect to federal sovereign immunity that is unrelated to Congress, that now it should just be regarded as not a right not to go to trial, but an affirmative defense. And before we get to the specific waiver here, that seems to me substantial. At least we should give considerable pause before we went off the cliff that you're asking us to go off of, which is to say that, which is another series of logical steps. We first have to say the federal government has no interlocutory appeals, and then second, because Congress is part of the federal government, albeit a separate branch, therefore it doesn't get any. That seems to me a lot of cliffs to jump off.
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that this court necessarily go as far as the Pullman decision. Pullman suggested that there can never be any federal sovereign immunity in any civil context.
You're asking us to go even further. You're saying that Congress doesn't get any either.
I'm saying that it would depend on the particular statute.
There's only one statute, isn't there?
In this case, that's correct. It's the Congressional Accountability Act. So one must look at the issue of the Congressional Accountability Act in the context of federal sovereign immunity and see if it makes out the three Cohen requirements. In terms of the Cohen requirements, I think your Honor is correct that the Johnson case prohibits interlocutory review in this case. Johnson stated that we are persuaded that immunity appeals interfere less with the final judgment rule if they're limited to cases presenting neat abstract issues of law. But this circuit has stated repeatedly in Goldman versus Bakai, Byers versus Burleson, that the discovery rule, what a plaintiff knew and when she knew it, are classic jury issues not fit for judicial determination, certainly not for interlocutory review. Now, the sergeant-at-arms keeps on stating these issues.
One of the oddities of Johnson is that many of those sort of very fine-grained factual issues are things that we do review in review of a summary judgment ruling.
That may be true, Your Honor, but for the purpose of the discovery rule, and especially in this case, the sergeant-at-arms has asserted these facts are undisputed, but they are disputed. And in fact, later on in her argument, she stated that the sergeant-at-arms does not agree with the facts put forward by the plaintiff. They posit one set of facts that suggest
I'm
that—
I'm sorry. I thought for purposes of this motion they accepted your allegations completely. That wrong?
If they accepted,
I didn't see any contest of that in your brief.
Your Honor, if they truly accepted our facts, then this would be a non-issue because Ms. Oskarson would have filed
timely. That's a different matter, but their contention certainly is that your allegations, whatever they are accepted for purposes of this motion.
And if
you have to live with that unless you point me to something that contradicts it.
No, if they truly do accept our facts, then her claim was timely, Your Honor.
Let me focus on this language. Completed counseling under Section 1402. So suppose that there's not a formal start of counseling, a formal request for counseling, but the plaintiff has had a conversation with whoever he or she would get counseling from in a hallway. Defendant says, well, that's not counsel, that doesn't add up to counseling under Section 1402. Has the jurisdictional requirement, clearly counseling is a jurisdictional requirement, right? You'd accept that.
That's correct.
So does that satisfy the jurisdictional requirement?
Well, the individual would certainly have to go through counseling. There's no question about that.
Well, take my hypothetical, this casual conversation in the hallway between the requester, who doesn't request, and the counselor, who, let's assume, doesn't give any counsel.
They
have a conversation about it, and they end up passing on and shrugging.
If that conversation was not actually counseling, then no, that would not be counseling. It would not satisfy 1402.
So you are saying that counseling, there must be counseling for jurisdiction.
That's correct. But 1408 does not import a timeliness requirement into the jurisdictional requirement.
How do we know which parts of 1402 are incorporated?
Your Honor, if Congress wanted to import a timeliness requirement into that provision, they certainly know how to do that.
Everybody knows that. Why people think that a slam dunk argument, I've never understood. Obviously,
if they did tell us, we wouldn't have to have any of these cases.
Well, there are situations in which Congress does tell us. For example, the sergeant-at-arms.
You know that too.
The sergeant-at-arms points to the John R. Sand and Gravel case. That case represented a dispute over the jurisdictional statute of the Federal Court of Claims. And the Federal Court of Claims jurisdictional statute says, every claim of which the United States Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction shall be barred unless the petition thereon is filed within 6 years. It was very clear that there was a timeliness requirement in the jurisdictional statute. 1408 does not contain a timeliness requirement. The Supreme Court has stated in multiple occasions in Irwin, in Arbaugh, in Zipes, in Citizens for a Better Government, Better Environment, rather, versus Steel Company, that if there's any doubt over that, the statute is simply not jurisdictional. The timeliness requirement is not jurisdictional in nature.
Yeah, you do read 1408 as making some kind of counseling a jurisdictional prerequisite. Now, what if instead of my conversation in the hallway, the employee requests counseling from some group other than the Office of Compliance. Do we have counseling within the meaning of 1402?
Again, 1402 states that you do have to go to the Office of Compliance.
Okay. So then is that counseling under 1402?
I suppose that would not be counseling.
As the term is used in 1408?
That would not represent counseling, no.
That would not represent. Now, 1408 doesn't explicitly say counseling with the Office of Compliance, right? So why is that not counseling under 1402, while belated counseling is counseling under 1402 within the meaning of 1408?
Because I believe it's a different
issue. It's obviously different, right. But why is it different?
Because 1402, what 1408 states is that you have to go through counseling with the Office of Compliance.
And it also says the request for counseling shall be made not later than 180 days after the date of the alleged violation.
1402 says that.
Yes.
But 1408 does not incorporate that requirement.
1408 doesn't say counseling with the Office of Compliance.
It says that you have to go through the procedure set up by the Office of Compliance. It says you have to go through 1402.
It doesn't say that. It says completed counseling under Section 1402. And you've accepted the proposition that under 1402 means counseling with the Office of Compliance, but you resist the idea that it means a timely request.
And perhaps I misunderstood Your Honor's question. I believe that if somebody, let's say, went to an office other than the Office of Compliance, then certainly they would have not followed the procedures under 1402.
Well, if they don't file their request within 180 days, they also haven't followed the procedures under 1402.
And I believe that would represent a violation of 1402, but it would not represent a violation of the jurisdictional provision of 1408.
Same could be said of going to the wrong office, the Office of X rather than the Office of Compliance.
That's right, and that would represent a violation of 1402, but there's nothing in 1408, the jurisdictional provision itself, that states, and you have to do it in the following ways in order for this to be jurisdictional.
What if you focused on the words, who has completed counseling under Section 1402, as being the requirement? Now, 1402 does have what sounds like an indication of what completed counseling means, namely, the office shall notify the employee in writing when the counseling period has ended. Is that your understanding then of when someone has completed counseling that the office has to notify?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, that at least takes care of the office problem. That is, if you go to the wrong office, you don't get that notice from the right office. What happens if the office just never notifies? Then what?
I understand that concern, Your Honor. But I don't think that would be, that would certainly be an internal problem. Whether that's a jurisdictional issue, that's simply not raised in this case. I don't know, Your Honor. In terms of the facts, the Sergeant at Arms has stated repeatedly that these facts are disputed. But let me tell you briefly what the plaintiff's version of the facts are. And for the purposes of this motion, they must be accepted as true. The spring of 2003.
If they're accepted as true, then you're conceding what the defendant says is the case, that there's not a dispute over facts with relevance to this motion.
And if that were the case, then Ms. Oskarson's contention is that her motion was timely filed, even under the discovery rule, that she did not know or should have known.
But this doesn't get you very far, because then we would have just a legal question, which is, what is the rule?
That's correct, that it would just be a legal question, but on the merits of this appeal, Ms. Oskarson would be entitled to judgment on this appeal because her matter was timely.
Do you have any idea what the district court decided on, whether the district court decided that didn't think the facts were sufficient, whether the district court liked your version of the law or the Senate's version of the law?
We don't know, Your Honor. It's simply a minute order.
And we're, both facts and law were argued, I take it.
That's correct. In terms of their discovery rule, we also believe that that is completely the wrong standard. It would set up a system in which a plaintiff's subjective belief about delay would represent a violation. But the violation under the ADA is not simply delay, it's unreasonable delay. They're positing a scenario where, for example, if a paranoid plaintiff made an accommodation request, and then 5 minutes later believed that there had been a delay, that would start her obligation to file.
Your rule is any time up to denial or grant? That any time during that time, it would accrue any time within that period?
That's correct, Your Honor, because we believe that an employee cannot be expected to know what the response to his or her accommodation request has been until the employer has actually given the response to the accommodation
request. Once they've given a response, what's the definition of unreasonable delay?
Once they've given a response, then an employee would have 180 days to file,
right,
and the jury would decide whether the facts of the case set forth unreasonable delay. And I suppose on a given set of facts...
How would the jury be told about what's unreasonable or not?
Well, generally, unreasonability is an issue for the jury to determine. They could certainly decide, you know what, it was the plaintiff in this case that had delayed. She didn't return the forms fast enough. She, you know, wasn't active in requesting her accommodation request. If the jury blamed the plaintiff for the delay rather than the defendant for the delay, they could certainly find that there had been no unreasonable delay.
Hearing no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Bach, how much time does she have? All right, well, that's my fault, so we'll give you another 2 minutes.
There's a few quick points. Under Arbar and Kontrick, Congress' use of the term jurisdiction, specifically in subsection A of 1408, shows Congress's intent to limit the class of cases that the district courts have power to adjudicate pursuant to Article 3 of the Constitution. By limiting their jurisdiction, Congress is explicitly retaining its longstanding immunity from suit. There was a lot of discussion about what under 1402 means. And the plain language means in accordance with. And that means it's incorporating the entire 1402, not just portions of it. That would include the timeliness requirement. It would include the requirement that the specific law the alleged violation is a law that actually has been waived under the Congressional Accountability Act. And would also require that the counseling occur with the Office of Compliance, as Judge Williams pointed out. To the extent that there is some ambiguity in this court's mind, that ambiguity needs to be resolved in favor of the sovereign. Waivers are to be construed narrowly, and the legislative history supports our reading, which I think is the better reading of Section 1408.
On that point about waivers being construed narrowly, what do you do with the Scarborough versus Principi opinion, in which the government made exactly the kind of argument you're making here? That is, the court says, the government insists most strenuously that the waiver of sovereign immunity from liability for fees, that was a fees case, is conditioned on the fees applicant's meticulous compliance with each and every requirement. And the court says, referring to Irwin and Franconia, court says, in these decisions, we recognize that limitations principles should generally apply to the government in the same way they apply to private parties. Once Congress waives sovereign immunity, judicial application of a time prescription to suits against the government, in the same way the prescription is applicable to private suits, amounts to little, if any, broadening of the congressional waiver. We further stated in Irwin that holding the government responsible is likely to be a realistic assessment of legislative intent, as well as practically useful principle of interpretation. And then in Arbaugh, it pretty much says that there has to be a clear statement, not just the kind of thing we're talking about here, which is sort of an implicit cross-reference and then implicitly picking up everything.
Well,
doesn't that sort of change the argument that we have to strictly construe a waiver? These Supreme Court cases sound like, at least with respect to timeliness, the sort of shoe is on the other foot.
Well, in those cases, the court was not construing the jurisdictional grant, the embodiment of the waiver itself. Here, we're actually construing the embodiment of the waiver itself. If you look at Irwin, that was dealing with a clear claims processing rule and not the grant of jurisdiction, which was in a completely, entirely separate section of Title VII. So to the extent, it's our position that Irwin doesn't apply at all. And to the extent it does apply, that presumption has been rebutted by the CAA's text structure and legislative history, which shows that Congress intended the jurisdictional grant to extend only to the classes of cases in which there is, among other things, a timely exhaustion of remedies. To ignore that requirement would impermissibly broaden the waiver and would contravene Congress's intent with respect to the power under Article 3 of the district courts to adjudicate the classes of cases that fall under the Congressional Accountability Act. One last point with respect to the merits. This court has made clear that the continuing violation theory does not apply to failures to accommodate, and it made that very clear in Mayors versus Laborers Health. There's no further questions.
Thanks very much. Case will be submitted.